Je suis Graham Carr, le président de la Fédération canadienne des sciences humaines, et il me fait très grand plaisir de vous accueillir aujourd'hui à cette causerie Voir Grand, la première causerie cette année dans notre série Voir Grand. I'm Graham Carr, the president of the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences. I'm thrilled to see so many people here today, some familiar faces, which is always great, but even more importantly, lots of new faces. I guess there are lots of new faces in this building at this moment in this year, and it's terrific to have so many of you here today. I'd also like to particularly extend a warm welcome to the members in Parliament and senators who have joined us, and in particular to Michael Chong, the Member of Parliament for Wellington Halton Hills, who is responsible for supporting this series and providing us with the opportunity to hold the series in this wonderful room this year. So I'll thank Michael again at the end, but I want to take the time right at the outset to thank him. The goal of the Big Thinking Lectures is really to bring research in the humanities and social sciences closer to those who can use it. Policymakers and legislators need current and relevant research to help inform the work that they do, to help inform the discussions that they do, and to develop sound public policy. La recherche en sciences humaines et sociales s'attaque aux grandes questions de notre temps et les chercheurs à travers le pays sont à l'œuvre afin d'éclairer les discussions et améliorer la vie des Canadiens et Canadiennes partout au pays. We're very pleased this morning to have a leading personification of the quality and excellence of social science and humanities research in Canada kicking off this first lecture of our series. A leading researcher in food security, Dr. Evan Fraser is a Canada Research Chair in Global Human Security and an Associate Professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Guelph. Dr. Fraser's multidisciplinary research integrates historic and current economic and environmental changes with land use and food security challenges, critically exploring ways of ensuring how citizens around the world can access nutritious food. And as we'll hear today, Dr. Fraser seeks to determine which regions of the world are most vulnerable to food insecurity, while also identifying how we, in a Canadian context, can rethink our food trade and our culture of food here in this country. So please welcome Dr. Fraser. He will speak for approximately 25 minutes, after which we will have a question period. I know that at 8:45 there are caucus meetings, so we won't be done by then. Please welcome Evan Fraser.
Well, thank you for that somewhat glowing introduction, which I don't quite recognize. And thank you for taking time out of what I know are extraordinarily packed schedules to come and look at pictures of soybeans. My topic, as was just noted, is addressing the global food crisis. And before I sort of start with the bulk of my lecture, I'd like to review a few statements that I quickly copied down while in a conversation. I'll tell you the speaker and the context of this conversation in a second, but these bullet points, for me, summarize what we think of when we talk about the global food crisis. First of all, the speaker, who, like I said, I'll talk about in a second, said Texas is out of water and agriculture will never be the same. And then the speaker went on to elaborate on how vulnerable the modern food system is to bad weather. They went on, China and India have started and will continue to buy commodities. This will have big effect on food markets, and there are going to be 9 billion people soon. And here the speaker elaborated on a bunch of factors which are going to increase our need to produce food. Urban sprawl is taking away farmland, and fossil fuels will be gone in 20 years. I'm not sure if I agree with this last statement, but here the speaker was sort of highlighting the fact that the things we need to produce food are becoming scarce and limited. Ultimately, and in the final assessment, the speaker said that food production needs to increase by 70% in the next 40 years, and if we fail this challenge, the next wars will be fought over war and fuel. Now, in addition to providing a nice summary of what we think of as the global food crisis, I was interested by the speaker because I'm used to these kind of arguments being made, normally by student radicals and environmental activists. In this case, the speaker was Mr. Steve Fried, Vice President of Research for ADM Investor Services, speaking to a group of students from the University of Guelph last month. And this is significant because ADM is one of those somewhat shadowy multinational corporations which is heavily invested in the commodities markets around the world. Steve's job in particular is to get up every morning and to send a bulletin out to ADM clients where he outlines the short, medium, and long-term trends that are likely to affect global commodity markets. And when he made these comments, he was responding to questions by our students about the future of the global food system. Where he was speaking was also interesting, because we were standing upstairs from this scene. This is the commodity trading floor at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the nerve center of the modern agricultural industrial system. So if people like Steve are getting excited by population growth, environmental change, urban sprawl, I am definitely going to sit up and take notice. Steve's comments echo those of Robert Zolnick, president of the World Bank, who a few months ago gave a speech where he said, "The world is one shock away from a full-blown food crisis." And another senior policy member who has spent significant time on this issue is Professor Sir John Beddington, the UK government's chief scientific advisor, who argues that the world faces a perfect storm of problems by 2030. And in particular, Beddington argues that food, water, and energy shortages threaten to unleash public unrest and international conflict. We can get a sense of what these guys are interested in by looking at a little bit of price data. What I've got here is the United Nations Food Price Index, which is a weighted average of 54 different types of food, and it gives us a snapshot of what food costs to consumers at any given point in time. What we see, flat, stable prices for about 20 years, and then these two dramatic price spikes. Now, when you look into the literature on these two very dramatic price spikes, there is very little consensus. Some authors focus on issues affecting supply, bad weather, droughts in Texas, droughts in Russia, that may have made mean it's more difficult, it seems to be more difficult for the earth to produce food than it did a generation ago. The second group of authors focus on issues affecting demand, population growth, our shift towards more meat consumption, and bioethanol, all of which is pushing our demand for food to record levels. Other authors point their fingers at people like Steve Fried from ADM and saying it's the commodity speculators who are driving up this volatility. And finally, other authors argue that overarching this entire problem is the rising specter of high energy prices. And energy is important because it's the major input in modern agricultural systems. Now, while there's no agreement as to the specific causes of the two price spikes we've witnessed in the last 3 years, there is an agreement, and a very strong agreement, that these are structural problems that are with us to stay. We are unlikely to go back to the good old days of these flat, stable prices that prevailed in the 80s and the 90s. And we get a sense that there's a significant political fallout of these price spikes. This is a map put together by the war journalist Gwyn Dyer about 7 or 8 months ago. And the countries indicated in red here are those countries that have experienced significant food riots over the past 3 years, where people have taken to the streets in violent protest, outraged at the cost of their daily bread. But for me, all of this brooks a sort of a fairly significant and important question. The future, indeed, from a food security perspective, looks highly uncertain. However, I don't think we need to go into it blindly. We don't know what the future is going to bring, and I think we can learn, in particular, important lessons from the past as a way of preparing ourselves for the challenges to come. We need to remind ourselves that as a species, we have 10,000 years of experience producing food and bringing it into cities. And overwhelmingly, through that 10,000-year period, the record of history is positive. The good years, decades and generations, outnumber the bad years, decades and generations. And we demonstrate time and again that we are technologically adept, adaptive, and an ingenious species. History, however, reminds us not to take this technological innovation and adaptive capacity for granted. The American Dust Bowl in the Midwest in the 1930s was triggered by a drought that caused an agricultural collapse that destroyed approximately 1 million acres of land and displaced a quarter of a million people from their homes. Rolling the clock back a couple generations from the Dust Bowl, we have the El Nino-induced famines of the late colonial period. This was a series of El Nino famines where El Nino events in the 1870s and 80s caused the Indian monsoon to falter, triggering a series of famines that one modern historian estimates claimed 40 million lives, arguably the worst natural disaster in the history of our species. What's interesting to me about these two events, the Dust Bowl and the El Nino famines, is the meteorological problem that triggered the catastrophe. They were not very significant. Compared with the historic record, the U.S. Midwest has experienced much worse droughts and will likely experience much worse droughts again. Similarly, the El Nino events weren't that strong. So maybe there's something we can learn about what makes a food system vulnerable to abrupt bad weather by studying cases like this. A third example I'd just like to touch on is the rise and fall of medieval Europe, pictured here in the form of Chartres Cathedral, much of which was built during the 12th century. Between 900 and 1300, France alone built 80 cathedrals, such as Chartres, 500 abbeys, and 10,000 parish churches. The population also quadrupled during this time. But between 1300 and 1400, a series of crop failures, famines, diseases, and wars killed about 40% of the population. So maybe I'm thinking there's something we can learn about how an advanced, technologically sophisticated, complex society, a society that has known nothing but 2 centuries or 3 centuries of relatively uninterrupted progress, can we learn something from this kind of case about how such a society hits a tipping point and descends into 2 generations of wretched misery? Now, I'm an academic. In particular, I'm a social science academic, so I write books, and I have written a book on this topic. So, the publisher of this book was Simon & Schuster, and Simon & Schuster has assured me that the sales of this book have been absolutely wretched. So you might consider it your patriotic duty to pull out your Blackberries, not iPhones, Blackberries, right now, and jump onto Amazon.ca and buy a copy of this book. And while you're doing that, I will save you the trouble of having to read the book and extract a few of the lessons in the forms of some patterns of history. The first thing that stands out as common in all of these cases that I've studied and my co-writer Andrew have studied is that in each case, new technologies allowed for huge increases in agricultural productivity. But this came at a cost, an environmental cost, because it also resulted in landscapes that were highly vulnerable, erosion-prone, and lacked biodiversity. And we can get a snapshot of this by looking at this medieval landscape painting where we see a peasant with a, by the time, extremely sophisticated heavy plow, a team of draft animals, and quite a complex arrangement of straps and harnesses and bridles and horse collars. The medieval historians are quite certain that there was an agricultural green revolution that started around the year 900 that was as significant for medieval society as our green revolution that started around 1950 was for modern society. This unlocked huge amounts of agricultural potential, freed people up from the land, and allowed them to move to the cities where they could do things like build cathedrals. We get a sense of the environmental cost of this by looking at this painting that was painted around the year 1300. And the first thing I'd have you note is the valley bottoms on the right-hand side, the undifferentiated sea of wheat. Now, from an economic perspective, this may be seen of as a productive, highly specialized, efficiently managed resource. From an ecological perspective, however, it's an accident waiting to happen. This sort of intensity of grain production is a surefire way of draining the soil of its nutrients, allowing pests and pathogens to build up, and if a fire gets established in this, that fire will go like the proverbial wildfire. It will spread over an enormous area. Similarly, I'd like you to note the hills at the back, where the cultivation has gone to the topmost extent. Again, from an economic perspective, this is maybe seen as a productive use of a marginal resource. But from an ecological perspective, once you've removed the native vegetation, exposed the soils to the weathering of the wind and the rain, you might get a crop 1 year, 2 years, maybe even a decade, for a decade. But all it will take is a bad weather event, a bad storm, and the natural capital in the world will wash away. It's a fairly similar story in the lead up to the Dust Bowl. In the 1910s and 1920s, the American farmer was the first generation to have access to tractors, which again unlocked a huge untapped agricultural potential and created a large amount of agricultural surplus that helped support vibrant urban economies. In doing so, they created a highly erosion-prone landscape. This leads to my second point, or the second pattern that stands out of history. This agricultural bounty supported vibrant and affluent urban populations that allowed for the building of the cathedrals, the roads, the hospitals, etc. But in doing so, each of these societies experienced a huge inequality in terms of wealth. It's no accident, therefore, that in the lead-up to those El Niño-induced famines in the 1870s and 80s, this was the period of time when the colonial government in India, the British Raj, was at its most opulent, while outside of the palaces were scenes of inhuman deprivation. The third thing that stands out as common in history in the lead-up to one of these crises, one of these perfect storms, is that the periods of expansion happened during a period of time when the climate was good. That meant that even vulnerable landscapes remained productive, and economically marginal families were able to survive. However, as the climate turned bad. And one of the lessons of history is that the good times, weather-wise, never last forever. And the climate is cyclical. When the weather turned bad, these food systems were unable to adapt. And we get a sense of this argument from this graph here, which I'll have to take a moment to explain. What we're looking at is 5,000 years of temperature for Western Europe. The horizontal axis, left to right, goes back to 3000 BCE, so we're looking far into the past. The wavy blue line is the average decadal temperature for Western Europe. And the point the authors of this paper are making is the Minoans, the Romans, and the medievals all enjoyed pretty good conditions for growing grain. And if you're interested in growing grain, and almost every civilization known to history is interested in growing grain, you need a few things to happen. You need a growing season that's at least 110 days long. In that growing season, you need average temperatures in the daytime of a mid-20s. In the evening, you need slightly cooler temperatures, and you need abundant but not excessive rainfall. And if you got these conditions, it's easy to grow abundant grain crops. If, however, the temperature changes, the growing season shrinks, the rains pick up or drop off, then you start experiencing significant yield declines. And the argument here is that the Minoans, the medievals, and the Romans all enjoyed this good weather conditions. And in doing so, they expanded at the expense of the environment and created this extremely inequitable society. And then when the weather stopped cooperating, the abused agroecosystems quickly became unproductive, forcing these marginal peasants into an ever more precarious existence, and society entered a period of a tailspin. Now, I think, unfortunately, in many ways, the modern food system falls into these same patterns. We can describe the modern food system in a similar way. The photograph here is of a ubiquitous scene in central North America. It's our high productivity cornfields. The corn that's planted here is a technological miracle. It's been bred to be highly productive. It has novel genes introduced into its germplasm to make it resistant to herbicide. It is nurtured along in a careful cocktail of pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers, and it's an intensively irrigated. It is extraordinarily productive, and this sort of field is a boon to our species and has freed up hundreds of millions of people from poverty and malnourishment. However, it has come at a significant environmental cost, a very significant environmental cost. Now, I don't want to spend my time today going through the litany of environmental challenges that are caused by modern industrial agriculture. I don't think that would be a productive use of our time. I'm happy to talk about that if that is of interest in the question and answer or follow up later. But I think we can take it as read that the scientific literature demonstrates there is a huge environmental cost associated with this level of productivity. Similarly, we too have created a highly inequitable system, both nationally and globally. I'm sure you're all familiar with the Conference Board of Canada's report from a few weeks ago that talked about how Canada itself was falling behind in terms of equity. The Conference Board of Canada also ran some numbers at the global scale and concluded that 42% of world income goes to the richest 10% of people, while the poorest 10% get only 1% of world income. So we are indeed a highly inequitable global society as well. For me, the inequity in the global food system is absolutely revealed when you consider the corn plant. Corn is the backbone of North America's food system. It's also the backbone of Africa's food system. But when you consider how corn is used on the two continents, it couldn't be farther from different. In Africa, people eat the corn. This is a photograph I took a couple years ago in southeastern Africa, the country of Malawi. And the gentleman you see at the back of this photograph is Dr. David M. Kwambizi, who's a former PhD student of mine. I visited David in his native Malawi, and as is very normal in this sort of circumstance, he took me to visit his family. Uncles, aunts, nephews, cousins, etc. What wasn't usual about this trip was that we had to bring large bags of corn into this community, because these people eat corn, eat almost nothing but corn, that is pretty much their only part of their diet, and they're chronically malnourished. It only took a few minutes of hanging out with David's nieces and nephews at the front of this photograph to realize that every single one of these kids has pus weeping out of their eyes or their ears, indicative of chronic ear, nose, or throat infections. And there was a general level of lethargy with these kids. I mean, I've got small children at home. I'm used to the high energy of kids. These kids did not display that kind of energy. So these people eat corn, and they need more of it. When you take the same plant and put it in North America, however, we use it for entirely different things, because we don't really eat corn. We have three primary uses for corn. First of all, we feed it to livestock. And in the case of cows, something in the order of 5 or 6 kilograms of corn goes to produce 1 kilogram of meat. We take the sugar out of our corn and we turn it into high fructose corn syrup or modified cornstarch, where it becomes the main contributor to the main ingredient in junk food. And we now take 40% of our corn and turn it into bioethanol. And the bioethanol plant I photographed here, I visited about a month ago, and I asked the manager of this plant, how much energy do you use versus how much energy do you produce? And what he said really blew my mind, because he said that for every calorie of ethanol he produces, he uses about 1.3 calories of natural gas. So it's deeply ironic, to put it mildly, that our renewable energy is actually existing on a subsidy of fossil energy. Now, I don't want to get into a debate today about the pros and cons of the ethanol industry, the cornstarch, corn syrup industry, or the livestock industry, because they're all complicated issues that deserve careful exploration. My point in this is much simpler. I just want to illustrate that when you contrast how Africans use corn and how North Americans use corn, you can't help but conclude that the world is deeply, structurally inequitable. And finally, as Time magazine reminds us, the weather isn't very good for producing crops right now. Forget Irene. The drought in Texas is the catastrophe that could really hurt, says Time magazine on August 31st of this year. And what Time magazine's article was reminding us is that when you look at the global food system, there's a tremendous number of very important grain-producing regions which are struggling to get crops off. Canada's doing quite well right now. Our crop is ahead of schedule. Our wheat crop is doing very well. And the international commodity markets are taking a big sigh of relief for that. But Australia, China, the USA, Pakistan, India, all of these places are experiencing below normal harvests in the last few years. And I think, without a shadow of a doubt, when we get to the 2050s, 60s, and 70s, we will look back on the 1950s, 60s, and 70s as some sort of golden age of good quality weather. The scientific literature is actually quite interesting on this one. It argues that between the Dust Bowl of the 1930s and about 10 years ago, the world's main grain-producing regions did not experience any really awful climatic shocks when compared with what they historically experience. We've had a very good century of crop production, or 50 years of crop production. We don't expect that to continue. This is illustrated by a photograph that accompanied the Time magazine article, which shows from Texas a posh resort that had a few years ago been on an island connected with the mainland on a causeway. Nobody is expecting this resort to be on an island anytime soon, and the short, medium, and long-term projections for rainfall for this area suggest the dry years are going to be quite entrenched for some time. So what can be done? I think that our food system looks at a structural level very similar to the types of problems that emerged in food systems in years gone by. But I would also like to remind you of my opening comments, where the lesson of history is actually quite optimistic, where the years and decades of progress outnumber the years and decades when crisis has happened. So I do indeed think there is room to wiggle, and that we can move proactively and in an informed way to prepare for what it looks like to be a very unsettled couple decades. And I again think history can help us, because throughout history, whenever one of these societies has faced a food crisis like this, four different types of solutions keep cropping up. And these four solutions are relevant still today. And the first solution goes something like this. The solution to a food crisis will be found when ingenious farmers and private investment create new ways of producing food. And this is the typical market-based response, the typical right-wing response. And this was picked up very explicitly in the Dust Bowl by the landscape painter John Stuart Curry in his painting Tornado Over Kansas. That shows Mother Nature's wrath descending on the farm family. But if you look at the farmer, he's not panicking. He's muscular, he's stalwart. He's a stalwart yeoman that is standing firm against the vagaries of nature. And the people of Kansas, specifically the Republicans in Kansas in the 1930s, loved John Stuart Curry and adopted him and adopted this painting as sort of their icon in opposition to the meddling of the Roosevelt government and the New Deal Democrats. What they were arguing is once the tornado passes, the family will come out of the storm cellar, and if they have access to capital, if they have access to tools, they will be able to adapt and come up with solutions. And this sort of free market type argument about ingenuity and technological development is relevant today. 1960 to 2005 is the x-axis, or the horizontal axis of this graph. The y-axis of this graph is grain yield, measured in kilograms per hectare. And when we look at the European Union, What we see is the average grain farmer in the European Union has tripled their productivity over the last 50 years. And this is because of technological development, hybridized seeds, fertilizers, the Green Revolution. When we look at Africa, however, we see a very different story. Yields have remained essentially flat and stagnant throughout this period. Closing this yield gap represents a technological, scientific, and engineering priority of the highest importance. It will require farmer ingenuity and private capital to come together, public capital, to come together to develop new technologies. But there's a more subtle lesson in this graph, and it's this. When the scientists who developed the Green Revolution technologies that created this miracle in Europe came together and started developing their tractors, their fertilizers, their sprays, their seeds, they made a number of assumptions about farming. They assumed that farmers had access to good quality land. They assumed that farmers had access to large amounts of land with relatively low amounts of labor, that markets were functioning and the politics were stable. And in that context, Green Revolution technologies worked brilliantly. However, Africa does not have fertile land. It has small farms. It doesn't have functioning markets, and it doesn't have stable politics. As a result, when we develop the next generation of agricultural technologies that will close this yield gap, we need to do it in a different way. We need to take science out of North America and Europe, and we need to put it in a partnership way, in a participatory way, in a humble, pedestrian, small-scale way with the African and Asian farmer. And develop technologies like this. This is a grain storage bag, which is resistant to the biting of rodents, so it's sort of tough burlap on the outside. The inside is treated with a compound that wicks away oxygen, so seeds stored in there don't hatch molds and don't hatch insects. The farmer that has access to this sort of low-cost, appropriate technology will be able to store their seeds and have better viability when they plant their seeds out the next year. The farmer that stores their food in this will have a better likelihood of having food left for the next in advance of the next year's harvest and be less likely to go hungry. This piece of technology was developed in a participatory way with small-scale farmers, identifying local needs and seeking to overcome them in an appropriate way. This is a very different model of how we do science than is what was generated during the Green Revolution in North America. Second type of solution is the regulatory approach, that governments are needed to regulate agriculture, create incentives that support sustainable farming practices, and penalize unsustainable practices. So where the first type of solution was sort of a right-wing, market-based approach, the second type of solution tends to fall back on government regulation. And this was also picked up in the 1930s by the landscape painter Alexander Hoag in his canvas Mother Earth Laid Bare. And Alexander Hoag hated the message of John Stuart Curry's Tornado Over Kansas, because Alexander Hoag thought the farmer was to blame for the problem, that farming practices had, in the most literal way possible, raped the earth and laid her open to the ravages of a bad weather. The response to this, and this was a painting that was picked up very dramatically by the Roosevelt government, the response is that we need government laws and regulations to prevent this sort of problem from happening, to discourage unsustainable farming practices. And this point was hammered home to me very recently. This is a photograph I took at a beef feedlot in the western USA that's licensed to hold 100,000 cows at a time. It's a huge operation, staggeringly big operation. As we traveled through the feedlot and the bus turned around on the end of our tour, I took this photograph and I asked the feedlot manager what this was. And he said it was a 410,000 ton pile of manure. 410,000 ton pile of manure. Incredible. It's also unconfined. In other words, it's not sitting on anything, and it's uncovered and it's exposed to the environment. It's about 15 meters from an irrigation canal and about a kilometer and a half from a river. It is a public health disaster. It is an ecological disaster. And I would argue that in this sort of instance, the regulator has failed to do their job. Because if the market allows for 100,000 animals to be confined in a space for a period of a year to be fed intensively on grain and then shipped off to market, then the market has failed to do its job in costing environmental costs and the environmental costs of this sort of operation, and the regulator needs to step in and do something about this. So the second type of argument that regularly comes up in the sort of debates over how to resolve a food crisis is the need for better regulation, and that argument was present in the Dust Bowl, present in ancient times, and indeed is present today. The third type of argument is epitomized here by Dorothea Lange's very famous photograph, again from the Dust Bowl, called The Migrant Mother. The migrant mother pictured here was a refugee from Oklahoma. She had abandoned her ruined farmstead, and with her and her family, her children, had either walked or hitchhiked to California, and they were employed picking beans when this photograph was taken. And the argument that's being made by Dorothea Lange is this. The real issue is that people are vulnerable and must be protected. And this is the social welfare debate. This is the humanitarian arguments that get talked about. And they represent a different type of solution to this sort of food crisis. But they're no less important because there's strong reasons for getting involved in humanitarian aid early. And the reason is this. If you can keep a farm system that's undergoing a crisis intact, if you can keep the people on the farms, you can create a situation where they don't have to liquidate all their assets, sell their tractors, sell their plows, sell their cows and their goats, then that system will rebound and much more quickly and be far more resilient in the long term. If, however, like it happened in the Dust Bowl, people abandon their land, lose their productive assets, it can take years and generations for an agricultural system to recover. This means that we need, at strategic locations and at many scales, to store more food as a buffer against a crisis. Unfortunately, storing food is something we've fallen out of the habit of in the modern day. I'll take you back now to southeastern Africa, country of Malawi, which I was referring to a minute ago. This is called the Strategic Grain Reserve Terminal, and it's just outside the capital city of Lilongwe. In the 1970s and 80s, the United Nations paid African countries to build this sort of infrastructure under the agreement that the countries themselves would then keep food, keep grain crops in these silos, and then if the crops failed and famine conditions started, they would be able to release this food into the market, keep prices down, keep people on their farms, give them a buffer, and that would help resolve the crisis. About 10 years ago, Malawi faced a crop failure, and the cabinet turned to the Strategic Grain Reserve Terminal here, opened the doors, and lo and behold, there was no grain. Now, the reason for the failure of this policy is twofold. First of all, in all likelihood, but it will never be proven in a court of law, a series of corrupt officials stole the food, hid it in unmarked bags, and sold it back into the market when prices were exorbitant. The second problem, however, was a matter of public policy. The International Monetary Fund, a few months before the crisis, had recommended, as part of one of their structural adjustment loans to the government of Malawi, that the government of Malawi reduce the amount of food they stored in the Strategic Grain Reserve. Far more efficient, the IMF argued, would be to sell the food, not have all this money invested in this depreciating asset, invest the money into the into development purposes or infrastructure, education, all good things, and then if you need the food, you can buy it back off the international market. Of course, and unfortunately, the people of Malawi discovered, to their chagrin, the failure or the flaw in this logic, and that when they turned to the market, when prices were high in their time of need, they found themselves unable to afford the food. As a consequence, thousands of people died in Malawi that year. And for many countries, the Strategic Grain Reserve now, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, tends to exist in theory rather than in practice. So I would say that in an important and often forgotten component of this humanitarian sort of policy, social welfare policy, is we need to reinvigorate the idea of the Strategic Grain Reserve. Maybe not the exact form of it. Certainly the way that was unfolded in the 80s was clumsy and prone to corruption. But the idea of storing food is extremely important. And these aren't problems only in poor African nations. In six of the last 11 years, according to the United Nations, the world ate more food than it produced. In another 3 years, including this year, we simply broke even. As a consequence, the latest food and agriculture projections suggest that our stocks are too low to provide an adequate buffer if this year's harvest is poor. In 2008, at the beginning of this international food crisis, the US was down to a 20-day reserve on soybeans and had stored less food than at any point since World War II. So I think as a matter of public policy, we need to engage with the idea of storing food, identify the appropriate facilities and the appropriate scales at which food needs to be stored, and create some buffers within our food system. The fourth and final type of solution that gets talked about in the lead up to one of these crises is again idealized for me in a Dust Bowl era landscape painting. Grant Wood, most famous for American Gothic's painting, Stone City, Iowa, gives us sort of an idealized vision of a rural community sort of nestled in harmony with a diverse agroecosystem and a diverse landscape. And to me, this identifies, or the message of this, is that of the alternative food movement. That the solution lies in developing a community-oriented alternative to the mainstream food system. Now, again, this is a debate that comes up whenever a society faces a crisis, and groups of people say we have to just forget about the mainstream system, it's hopelessly flawed, and develop something that's on a much more local alternative scale. And of course, this is the movement that every Saturday morning goes to the Guelph's farmers market, that goes to a community-supported agricultural scheme that supports a slow food movement or engages in some sort of 100-mile diet exercise. Again, I think this is an extremely important part of the sort of strategies we need to be embarking on as we face this very unsettled future. Now, I'm going to say something that to my hippie friends is a little controversial. The alternative food movement will never and should never feed all of us all of the time. That wouldn't be efficient. In a world of 9 billion people, we don't have the luxury of producing grain in a local way if we are living in an area that isn't efficient to produce grain. Where I used to live in northern England made ideal pasture land. It would have been ludicrous to try to do grain production in Yorkshire. Yorkshire should specialize in pasture. The prairies should specialize in grain. But that level of specialization doesn't mean we forget about the local food system as irrelevant or unimportant. It still is important. And the best way I could think to illustrate this is with a map of Toronto's Greenbelt legislation. Now, Toronto's Greenbelt legislation is argued by some to have been highly controversial, highly expensive, and executed in a somewhat ham-fisted way. I'm not going to take issue with those points. In many regards, they're probably right. It isn't a controversial and expensive policy. And we are foregoing all sorts of development opportunities by locking our land as farmland. However, I would say maintaining the productive capacity of our urban regions, which means keeping the land as farmland and supporting the farmers, so there's a gap in the policy, but that's a separate issue. Keeping this productive capacity functional is extremely important. As the international food system comes under these shocks and stresses that all these senior people, business people, policymakers, president of the World Bank think it's going to, we are going to be so glad to have this insurance policy, this plan B, this buffer between the urban consumer and the vagaries of the international commodity markets. And so on the short term, this may seem like an expensive piece of public policy, but if we project out to this world of climate change, of economic change, of population growth, of soil degradation and high energy prices, we're going to be so glad that we made this investment early on maintaining the farms and indeed the farmers of our local areas. As I wrap up, because I wanted to leave room for questions. What we've got here, I think, are four different types of solutions. We've got the individualistic free market solutions, and this is particularly important in developing new technologies in Africa. But they have to be done in a participatory and way on a level playing field between scientists, engineers, and farmers. We've got the managerial bureaucratic solutions, which call for government regulation to make sure that our environment is not abused by inappropriate farming practices. We've got the social welfare solutions, and of which the social welfare solutions, I would say the most important element or the forgotten element is storing food as a buffer against the crisis. And we've got the communitarian alternative solutions, maintaining the local food system. All four of these solutions contain parts of the holistic solution. All four of these represent sort of a portfolio of strategies that needs to be embarked on in order to weather the storm that's coming. In looking at the cases of history, the cases of societies that survived and prospered during these sort of food crises are ones where there was a healthy dialogue between these four components. There was a level of mutual respect between these four components, and the societies embarked on strategies and policies that covered off this entire space. Societies that faltered, societies that went through crises, are those where politicians, pundits, academics became isolated and entrenched in ideological camps that sort of fall out according to these four different dimensions. So if there's one message I would have to you today, it's that to engage in a discussion that acknowledges that each of these elements will contain important aspects of the solution and not get ideologically entrenched in one or other camp. Last slide, as I just bring this to a close. I'd just like to review what I've talked about. I teach a lot of undergraduate lectures early in the morning, and it's important to have a wrap-up slide at the end. Helps for studying for the exam. Food systems throughout history have constantly struggled to adapt to changing environmental and social conditions. Fragile systems are those with erosion-prone specialized landscapes, inequality in access to resources, and have enjoyed prolonged periods of pretty good weather. I worry that today all of these conditions are indeed present. I also talked about developing solutions. Historically, I think four types of solutions are debated. I have called these technocratic, bureaucratic, welfarist, and communitarian. Those are wonkish academic words. I can change the words. The points, the concepts behind them is what's important. Each of these are crucial elements of what I would consider a holistic solution, and we must seek to find strategies that combine all four of these factors. Thank you for your time.
That was terrific, Evan. Thank you very much. I want to turn it right away to questions. If you have questions, please come to the microphone in the center of the room and identify yourself. Si vous préférez de poser des questions en français, n'hésitez pas. Yes.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Heyer. I'm the MP for Thunder Bay Superior North. Evan, that was incredible. Wow, you woke us up and depressed us a bit too, but it stimulated about 100 questions in my mind. I'll just address one. Your talk was pretty focused on quantity of food, but only a little bit on quality of food. Cro-Magnon's males averaged almost 6 feet tall. Cro-Magnon women averaged about 5'10". And for 10,000 years, all this grain production and grain eating and lack of diversity and nutrients in our diet has resulted in people who are shorter and fatter than our ancestors and were genetically predisposed. So. Do you have something to add about that? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that question, Bruce. And it's absolutely true that when you look at the archaeological record, prehistoric societies seem to live longer and happier and healthier than early agricultural societies. And when we developed agriculture, we took a major step back in terms of our quality of life. We worked harder and we lived shorter and got more diseases in agriculture than we did as hunter-gatherers. Agriculture, I think, was probably a necessary response to changes in the environment and population growth that made hunting-gathering, which only works if you've got a very low population density. So the question then becomes, can we reconnect with some of the benefits of this earlier golden age, this Garden of Eden-like existence that we had 12, 13,000 years ago? And the short answer, I think, is yes. I mean, we have these enormous tools available to us to eat. We don't have to just eat corn in North America in different forms. And frankly, the evidence is pretty compelling that the role of corn in the North American diet is, as you pointed out, rightfully quite bad for us and linked directly to our obesity epidemic, our diabetes epidemic, the pollution associated with industrial livestock. And so I would say that that this problem has emerged over the last, say, since 1974, when the U.S. Farm Bill was instituted, that highly subsidized the production and the research around corn, that we have then evolved over the last 30 years, or 40 years, this food system that is totally oriented towards corn. And we need to change that. And there's obvious policy levers to change it. Nutrition programs at school would be primary school would be a very logical place to start, you know, reinvigorating what used to be thought of as home ec classes for kids as a way of teaching balanced diet, nutrition, basic food literacy skills, and basic food production. And I think we could, without too much effort as a society, correct some of these problems, nutritional problems that run through Western society quite badly. So thanks for that question.
I'm not a Cro-Magnon, so I have to stand on my toes to get up here. I wish I were. I'd like to carry a club and walk around in a furs. Jim Birch, this summer a group of 25 volunteers formed a network in Ottawa to find ways to protect agricultural biodiversity. And if we can succeed at a simple way of doing that in Ottawa through marketing and foster farms for seeds and so on, we'd like to export the model to other cities. So I wonder if you could give us some encouragement and ideas.
Well, I mean, the short answer is yes. I would love to give you encouragement for that kind of initiative. That sounds great. I don't know anything about this particular initiative, but I'd appreciate, you know, if you had some literature or could send me an email with a web page, I'd be very grateful for that. I would say from a policy perspective and an institutional perspective, some of the core changes that I'm seeing in terms of supporting local food, high diversity within local agricultural regions, I mean, that's coming out of the corporate world. So, I mean, I've had regular conversations with Loblaw executives and met with Galen Weston earlier this year. And what amazed me about these conversations is much like my quoting Steve Fried at the beginning of my talk, here we have some very influential corporate players who have acknowledged the fact that the food system that they currently have built their business model on is in the process of changing. Loblaw's business model is too dependent on good weather and cheap oil to do its business. And they want to be ahead of the change that's coming, and are, as a result, investing heavily in relationships with the Buy Close to Home campaign, for example. And so there's a tremendous amount of energy, as yet I think somewhat unfocused and preliminary, but sincere energy in the corporate world, in the retailing world, to start encouraging people like that initiative you just briefly told us about, to do more of that and to get that established and integrated into the retailers' supply chains. So I would say that this is the beginning of a large-scale change, and the retailers that I've at least spoken with seem to be very eager to start talking about alternative ways of procuring food that do some of these things that you just suggested.
Hi, it's Gail Motzi from CHF, Canadian Hunger Foundation. You had an opening slide that I just haven't been able to get out of my head, and I wondered if you could comment on it. It was the remarks from Stephen Fried of ADM, and the one comment in particular that we need a 70% increase in agriculture production. And then I think later on you talked about the distribution inequity issues, etc. And I'm just wondering, it seems that it's self-serving for him probably to promote an alarmist view that we just need to have more industrial agriculture in order to meet this increasing demand. But there is the distribution question, if you could talk about the relationship between the two.
Yeah. Thanks for that question, Gail. And what you've hit at there is one of those mother of all conundrums, which I just literally stay up late at night thinking about, because I can't get this one out of my head either. So Steve Fried was referring, when he said that the world needs to produce 70% more food, that's a statistic comes out of the UK government's Foresight Report, which is on the future of farming and agriculture, which was published earlier this year. Lead author was Professor Sir John Beddington, who I quoted earlier. And it represents a very serious scientific effort to make an estimation of what our global food needs are going to be in 2050, I believe is their benchline year, relative to what we think we can produce with a business as normal scenario. So they project demand out, they project supply out, and they say, oh boy, we've got a big gap opening up. And that language, that alarmist language, has absolutely been picked up by the American industrial food industry. People like Steve Fried. I then was visiting a Pioneer seed manufacturing plant in Iowa where they breed new varieties of corn. And I had the same conversation with the lead scientist there as I had with Steve Fried. We need to boost yield to feed the world. On the other side of the coin, we've got this inequity. We've got not enough corn in Africa and arguably too much corn in North America, so much corn that we use it in what some people would consider highly inefficient ways, feeding it to cows, turning it into bioethanol, creating junk food out of it. And so this gets at this equity issue that I can't wrap my head around. On one side of the coin, we have so much food right now that we're poisoning ourselves with it. And so the fella, and I don't want to make this personal, but the fella at the Pioneer plant that I talked to that says we need to boost our triple our productivity of corn, I mean, he was an enormously obese man that had eaten too many corn products over his life. And so you're just confronted with the irony or the disconnect between this abundance of the American corn industry, the North American corn industry, the somewhat foolish things we seem to do with corn because of all this corn, the absolute lack of basic carbohydrate and protein in places like Malawi. And there's got to be a way of righting that balance. Overshadowing all of this is this global population, global demand, global supply projections, which suggest that although we're at surplus now and we have this inequity problem now, when we look out 50 years, we're expecting to experience a bigger gap. And I don't know how to bring those two ideas, which seem mutually exclusive, together. And if you've got any thoughts on how to bring those together into one intellectually tidy bundle, I'd love to talk to you.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Yard, and I'm with the City of Ottawa.
Hi,
looking
Rebecca.
Looking forward to having you at the city later.
Well,
later
you've
this
heard
morning.
It all now. You can not go this afternoon.
I'll sharpen my question. I love the fact that you challenged ideological rigidity in this particular context and very eloquently, because I think that's something that we need to challenge in all realms. So the fact that you found a focus for it that seems to be well supported by evidence is really powerful. But what I'm wondering, and I'm assuming that your book actually takes the point that you made, that the civilizations and the parts of the world that have flourished in times of food crisis are the ones that have managed to address all of those dimensions of sort of, you know, policy and technology. Are there actually examples that are strongly supported by that evidence and the reverse?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually not in my book. The book's 2 years old. Well, I finished working on it about 2 years ago, and so I've had time to think about these issues in the intermediate 2 years. The biggest example, the best example, was one that actually came up last night when I gave a version of this talk to a group of grad students. And in the early 1990s, there was a terribly bad drought in southern Africa. All across southern Africa, from a meteorological perspective, was a very, very bad problem. However, in that case, we had good technologies in place, specifically in the form of medium-term weather forecasting, which anticipated that the rains were going to stop falling for a few years. We had a high level of institutional capacity. This was just after the apartheid regime fell apart, and the world's interest was on making South and Southern Africa actually work. So there was a tremendous amount of effort placed on it. There was effort to keep local markets functioning in the form of distributed food aid, and that kept people on their farms and didn't have them starting to migrate, abandon their productive assets, abandon their land. And as a result, despite the fact there was an intense meteorological problem in the early 1990s, there were virtually no deaths, except in one country that had significant civil war going on. It was an example of multi-level governance, technology, and economics all working together to overcome what was otherwise a very significant problem. By contrast, in Somalia right now, the drought that's causing the famine in Somalia, you can't even measure meteorologically. In Ethiopia in the early 1980s, the drought that sparked the Band-Aid movement, I went through the meteorological record, the weather station records, and I can't see the drought measured in rainfall relative to other years. It was tiny. It's not that it wasn't there. It's that the system was so fragile and so brittle that even a small perturbation in meteorology caused the system to unravel. And so I think, for example, just in Africa in the last 20 years, we have good examples of situations where people did come together and overcome these problems, this massive drought in the early 90s, versus Ethiopia in the 80s, where a tiny perturbation triggered a massive catastrophe.
Thanks, Evan. And my job is to keep the freight train running on time, and we only have a few minutes left. So I would like to invite Michael Chong, the MP for Wellington Halton Hills, to step forward and thank Evan, and again use this opportunity on behalf of the Federation to thank Michael for his support of this series and making it possible for us to hold it here. Michael?
Well, thank you, Graham. Thank you for coming today to organize this. It's a very interesting talk. I wanted to welcome all of you from the humanities and social sciences here on Parliament Hill. There's some 85,000 members, I think, of your association. So as a humanities graduate myself, I value the work that you do, and it contributes greatly to the public policy and decisions that are taken here in the nation's capital. So thank you for coming here, and welcome, and I hope you have a great conference. I also want to, in particular, thank Dr. Fraser for his interesting talk. I go to a lot of speeches and talks, and you have a very engaging style, and I found it very interesting. So thank you for highlighting the challenges facing global food production and for presenting some of the potential solutions, not just in a unidimensional way, but in your nuanced way, and giving us lots of food for thought as we as public policymakers meet the challenges of not just agricultural production here in Canada, but feeding the world. So thank you very much, and as a Wellington County boy myself, it's nice to see somebody from the local region up here in Ottawa talking to folks up here. So we have a little gift for you. Thank you very much, and good luck on the rest of your conference.
Thanks.
Thank you, Michael, and Evan, let me just take the opportunity to thank you as well. Geographers have that capacity to speak across many disciplines. They integrate history and art history and economics and philosophy and public policy. And I've probably left out several bases that you touch, but I think that also underlies the richness of the work that the people in our community do. Pour terminer, j'aimerais profiter de l'occasion pour remercier aussi le Conseil de recherche en sciences humaines du Canada, le président Mr. Chad Gaffield, qui est parmi nous aujourd'hui. The Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada is a good friend of the Federation, and we thank Chad and the other wonderful members of the team, many of whom are here this morning. I also want to just put you on notice that this is the first of 7 big thinking lectures that we'll be hosting this year on Parliament Hill. The next one, which will take place on October 20th, features Philip Kelly of York University, whose SSHRC-funded research focuses on another important public policy topic, labor market integration of immigrants. And you will be receiving reminder notices from our team at the Federation. Hope you can all make it to that event on October the 20th. Thank you again, Evan, and I look forward to seeing all of you next time.